The Thirsty Developer, episode number 20 for April 30th, 2008. Server Girl on Hyper-V. Welcome, everyone, to The Thirsty Developer. This week, we're going to be talking with Beth Humphreys, who's affectionately known as Server Girl, and we're going to be talking to her about virtualization with Windows Server 2008. But first, Larry, I want to talk to you about this event that I attended over the weekend. We actually had, you know, we've been having these launch events for, you know, the Visual Studio, Windows Server, SQL Server launch events that we've been having in various cities throughout the world. And, you know, we've been having some, you know, live events. We've got a virtual launch that we have at heroeshappenhere.com. But actually, I attended a different type of virtual launch event that was actually put together and hosted by Zane Nabolsi, who's our good friend and comrade down in Dallas down there. He actually held a virtual launch event in Second Life over the weekend, and I attended it, and it was, you know, I'll have to say, at first I was kind of hesitant because we know Second Life. You know, Second Life is this kind of virtual world where you kind of create your own little avatar, and it's a 3D environment. You kind of walk around and fly around and go to different locations and people's islands, and they build houses, they build stores, they build these various artifacts in world. They call it in world. But actually, Microsoft has an island in Second Life, and it's the Visual Studio Island, and this is where they had this launch event. And it was actually kind of interesting. I was hesitant at first, but once I kind of got in there and started interacting with other people, you know, I was like, this is pretty interesting.
So was this your first extended period kind of in world, as they call it?
Yes, it definitely was. You know, so I've played, you know, games like, you know, World of Warcraft, where you're kind of playing with other people and, you know, kind of, you know, quote unquote in world, right? Second Life, you know, same kind of concept, however, it's not a game. It's kind of a game, right? If the game is to try to make money, but
Dave, they don't like it when you call it a game. I know that for a fact, because I made that mistake to Zane and Jay Sawyer, you know, who are two of our evangelist buddies who are really into Second Life,
right?
And Second Life evangelism is what they call it, but don't call it a game.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's not a game. I mean, you can make it into a game, I suppose. If your game is making money, yeah, it's. So the idea is that, you know, you kind of, you know, my experience was, you know, I had this kind of this avatar or whatever. You give them give them some name or whatever. You can't, you know, when you kind of sign up for Second Life, you can't give it your real name. They only give you. You can create your own first name, but then they give you kind of a list of last names to pick, and I'm not quite sure why that is, but maybe to protect people, I don't know, make sure it's anonymous or something. I have no idea, but so you create your avatar, and once you kind of get used to walking around in Second Life, and I have to be honest with you, I'm still kind of stumbling my way because I'm sort of used to the World of Warcraft controls. I'm stumbling my way around, you know, in Second Life, and once you kind of find somebody, you know, off to the side, I had an IM conversation going with Zane, you know, kind of like, help me. Where do I need to go? And essentially, you go in there, you kind of just type in search, you know, Microsoft or Visual Studio Island, and you have this opportunity where you can go to the island through what they call teleporting. So you kind of click on the name and you say teleport, and it takes you right there. So I did that. And so what was going on is that they kind of had like this central meeting place where they kind of had they had people in world directing you where to go. So if you wanted to attend, say, the Visual Studio sessions, you know, go to this location. If you want to attend the Windows Server sessions, go to this location, and SQL Server and so on. So they kind of had like these billboards and maps.
It's kind of like the real launch event, right? Where there
exactly.
People are there directing you. Okay.
Yeah, the human pointers. Yeah, exactly. So they had like these billboards of the maps where you can click on the islands and stuff, and it was pretty interesting. So I found out I wanted to go to Visual Studio Island, so it showed me where to go, and I flew over there, which is hilarious. And then they kind of have like these auditoriums set up where they got seats and kind of a stage and a screen. And I guess what they do is they're able to upload like slides. And I'm not sure how they do this. And maybe we can get Zane on here to describe it to us at some point in time. They upload the slides. So in kind of in world, there's like this big screen behind the podium that has the slides. And then in this case, Jay Sawyer did a couple of sessions, and then Zane did some of the sessions. So they're essentially standing on stage, And they're able to use Second Life now has this voice chat, right? So you can actually talk into a headset, and you're able to communicate to everybody that's sort of within that location. So in this case, you're within this kind of this auditorium setting, so everybody can hear the voice chat that's coming through Second Life, and they start the session. They kick it off, and they show the pictures of the slides as they walk them through, and they're doing a virtual session in world. And so you're sitting there as an avatar, you're sitting in the session, and it's kind of like a webcast, but you're able to interact in a way that you're not typically able to do in a webcast. Like, they had chat windows going on where people are able to chat back and forth, but then also people would find out that, you know, I was from Microsoft, that they would institute a chat session with me, so they have a conversation going off me one-on-one while the session's going on. I'm able to answer questions and do this and do that. So they had this interactive element that was actually pretty interesting. And then when they wanted to switch to the demos, essentially what they did is they had a live meeting session set up, and they would paste the link to the live meeting inside Second Life, and people would click on it, and that would then launch into live meeting. They would switch over to there, all the while, you know, doing the voice chat through Second Life, but walking through the live meeting demos and walking through the code. And then when they want to switch back to slides, they'd come back to Second Life. So I was hesitant at first, but at the end of the day, I was like, you know what? This is something here. This is actually kind of interesting because it gives you a way to interact with people, you know, that you can't do with a typical webcast. So I was pretty impressed, actually.
Well, that's cool. You know, Zane's supposed to take a bunch of us, and, you know, we're going to have a live meeting where he's going to teach us about Second Life. And it sounds like you're ahead of the class there. But
I still have a lot to learn.
Yeah, I don't get it, but it's intriguing enough that I think I'm going to take Zane's, you know, kind of, you know, primer class, you know. I'm still concerned about the whole nakedness thing.
Yeah, you know, so that is a point. I mean, I think if you control the island, you can kick people off if they're sort of misbehaving, if you will. But I will have to say, I was a little disturbed at first when I sort of took a seat and, you know, sat to kind of listen to the session. You know, there was a guy, you know, an avatar that was sitting next to me that didn't have a shirt on. Not that I was paying attention to anything, but I just happened to notice that. At least he was wearing pants, so that's good. But wow. but he wasn't causing any problems, so it was no big deal. But yeah, it was definitely interesting. But I think for me personally, I think what was special about it was just the interactiveness that it provided. You know, people are able to chat and communicate, and it was actually kind of funny because after, you know, so this went on all day, right? It was a full launch event. It ran the same agenda schedule as a real life quote unquote launch event, and then at the end of the launch event, they kind of had a virtual party on the island. And, you know, they which is kind of funny if you think about it, but they set up like this dance floor, and they had the disco lights, and, you know, and they had the, you know, you could set the avatars to dance and all that. That's when I was like, okay, that's enough. And then I had to sort of log off at that point. But it was definitely kind of interesting. But it's, like I said, it was a very cool way for people to interact. And as it turns out, that it was, I mean, there were people all from all over the world that were actually attending the event that day. I mean, there were people from, I believe they said, you know, people from China and Ireland and Brazil and Europe and obviously the United States. So definitely very interesting. And as it turns out, this was actually partially, you know, or co-hosted by the SecondLife.net user group. So there's actually a user group, a .NET user group in Second Life, and I believe they meet every other week or maybe once a month. Go to we'll have a link in the show notes, but essentially it's SLDNUG.com, SecondLife.net usergroup.com. And they have a calendar of all their meetings and stuff, but they actually hold the user group meetings in world. It's just like a typical user group. So something definitely keep an eye on. It was definitely interesting and scary at first, but once you got sort of past that, it was definitely interesting.
You know, David, sounds like you had a lot of fun.
I did. It was a good, you know, actually it was kind of a good way to spend a dreary Saturday afternoon that was just cold and rainy outside. So gave me something to do to.
So coming back into the real world, our interview today was actually recorded at the you know, real world launch in Madison, Wisconsin, and you mentioned that they had, you know, the multiple tracks, you know, in the Second Life launch. They also have multiple tracks, you know, in you know, the real world launches. First world, I guess, is what it is, right? First life.
That's right. But, first life.
But one of the more interesting ones to me is, you know, the whole Windows Server, you know, the launch of Hyper-V. Right. And we brought our old pal Server Girl on for today's interview.
And Server Girl is actually Beth Humphreys. And Beth Humphreys is one of our coworkers. She works as part of the Midwest evangelism team, you know, based out of Chicago. And she, her actual title is, what is it? It's Infrastructure Architect Evangelist, I believe it is. I think it changes every year, right? But yeah. So essentially, Beth is, you know, she's obviously evangelizing Windows Server as the platform and kind of, you know, the you know, typically in, interacting with IT pros and talking about, you know, the kind of issues that they have. And yeah, so Hyper-V is definitely something that's on her plate as of late and something she's really, really passionate about.
And I think it's really interesting to developers, you know, and during the interview, you'll find that Beth is wanting to talk about, you know, rolling it out in the enterprise. And I was like, you know, let's kind of like, you know, keep it on focus here with what developers can do with it. Because, you know, virtualization is just, you know, a godsend for developers. Being able to test on multiple operating systems, multiple combinations of browsers, you know, without having to have, you know, a lot of hardware, you know, taking up your desk space.
Yep. So let's, why don't we check out that interview with you and Beth.
Hi, this is Larry Clarkin, and I'm at the Madison, Wisconsin Heroes Happen Here launch event, which is our combined Visual Studio, Windows Server 2008, and SQL Server 2008 launch. And I'm here in the speaker room, the staff area, and I've caught up with our old pal, Server Girl, Beth Humphreys. Beth, can you say hi?
Hi, everybody.
So, Beth, this is the Thirsty Developer, and we talk about, you know, development architecture topics. So why is Server Girl on the show today?
Because Larry's letting me be on the show today.
No, we actually asked you. You know, a lot of people, you were a guest host on a couple of episodes ago. And, you know, everybody found out that the Search the Developer guys know Server Girl.
Yep.
And they wanted to know more about you. And specifically wanted to bring you on to talk about a topic that's actually getting, you know, launched, you know, today as part of the Windows Server 2008
mm-hmm.
launch.
Right.
And so we're going to talk about, you know, server technology, but it's going to be very near and dear to the developer's heart. And that technology is Hyper-V.
Virtualization.
So, virtualization. And so tell us a little bit about virtualization in general.
So if we want to look at virtualization from a Microsoft perspective, we like to look at it from a 360-degree view. So we've got virtualization of your presentation layer, which would be our terminal services offerings. We've got virtualization of your servers, which is our Hyper-V product. Our previous version was Virtual Server 2005.
And Virtual PC, you know, that's more of the developers would be familiar with.
Exactly. Yep. And it's not necessarily server virtualization. VPC is not necessarily.
Right.
And then we've got application virtualization, which is a very interesting topic, but unfortunately we're not going to talk about that today.
Right.
So there's several different aspects of virtualization that we look at from a Microsoft perspective. That's a little bit different from other virtualization technologies that are out there. We don't like to look at it just as a server technology. We like to look at it, you know, for your entire infrastructure perspective. And in the middle of all of that is management, because you cannot have virtualization, I don't care what layer it's sitting on, without management.
Yeah, and that's what makes it kind of tick. We're going to specifically talk about the new feature of Windows Server 2008 from the development perspective today, and that is, you know, Hyper-V. And that is fundamentally, you know, I can run more than one operating system or more than one instance of the same operating system on one machine. And developers love this technology. I mean, I know personally when I used to write code, now that I do a lot of other stuff, I like to play with different OSs. And I like to do it in such a way that I don't have to have, you know, five different laptops, you know, sitting on my desk at any given time.
Or five different servers sitting in a lab.
Yeah.
And being able to spin up a different server at any given time based on a specific configuration, it's very handy in a dev and test scenario. Virtualization, no matter what technology you use, if we want to look at it just from a pure technology perspective, being able to have a nice, solid, and easy-to-use dev and test QA environment is very simple with Hyper-V.
Yeah, and that's, you know, from my perspective, you know, when I'm doing, you know, some code, I like to work in Windows Vista. But at the same time, I'm going to deploy on Windows Server 2003 or 2008. Mm-hmm. You know, so I want to have an instance of there so I can actually test in the environment that I'm going to deploy before I start pulling on my infrastructure resources to say, really deploy this on a real server and have to deal with, you know, any compatibility issues that I've got. But also I want to have, you know, because I do a lot of web development, I want to target, you know, IE6, you know, or, you know, some other different browser. And IE6 doesn't run on Vista or, you know, Windows Server 2008. So I've got to have like an XP virtual machine sitting around to do that kind of stuff.
Exactly. So you have to have a whole library that kind of reflects your, basically, it'll reflect your production environment, you know, down from the client all the way up to maybe your server infrastructure.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I've been playing with the Moonlight bits quite a bit, you know, which is, you know, our, you know, kind of open source, you know, sister companion to Silverlight.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've been doing that on Ubuntu, you know, so I've actually got a Linux distro running, you know, kind of alongside that.
Mm-hmm.
So I can develop my Silverlight application. I can see how it looks on Linux, you know,
cool.
And that's another way of, you know, of utilizing this.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about how a developer would actually get started, because I think that's a whole different conversation for, you know, from a server deployment standpoint. And that's generally the conversations you have, right? You're talking to the infrastructure architects at the big companies, and they're like, you know, server girl, you know, I have 5,000 servers and they're in different states and all that. How do I deploy virtualization? But I want to talk specifically about like how an individual person might get started to leverage this. So, you've been helping me out a lot. So how do you get started?
Well, it's fairly easy. You can grab, if you know, from MSDN, the current release where we're standing today in terms of today's date and our launch, the way that we have put how we're going to deploy Hyper-V in our timelines is 180 days from RTM of Server 2008. So the current RTM of the current version of Server 2008 that we have released right now, you can grab from MSDN, and that has beta 3 of Hyper-V.
Okay.
So what I would do is I go grab those bits, and you have many options to install. So if any of you have not installed Server 2008 somewhere, install it somewhere, and you're going to notice there's a big difference between the experience of installing it from 2003.
Yeah.
Huge difference in your experience. So I would say the first place you would go is MSDN.
And
go grab
just,
the bits.
Yeah, I just want to just really quick clarify for anybody who might be listening. You know, she's talking MSDN. That's the MSDN subscription, you know, which I know a lot of our listeners have MSDN subscriptions.
Right.
If you're working at a company where you don't have access to the MSDN subscription, you know, talk to your, you know, your administrator and, you know, see about getting a copy of it. But the easiest way is if you've got an MSDN subscription, just to pull that down.
Exactly.
And when you said RTM, that is release to manufacturing.
Exactly.
Which was
Release to market, to manufacturing.
Which was early February. You know,
yes, early February.
We're a couple months, you know, after release, you know, and everything's going, you know, smooth, right?
Yep. Everything is going smooth. We're moving along with the development of Hyper-V as, you know, as we iterate it along.
So one of the things you mentioned, though, I want to go back to this beta 3 thing, because this is kind of new and a little unprecedented for Microsoft. We have a released product that you can download. It's the shipping bits. It's supported under your Premier support contract and all that. That has beta software sitting on top of it?
Absolutely. The goal that we are trying to accomplish here is to try to get virtualization technologies in the hands of everybody, because we think that it is a technology that has so many benefits, and we don't want price necessarily or availability to be a blocker for getting this into the hands of even the smallest customers that we have. So, I mean, if you look at it from, if we were to look at it from a competitor standpoint, the price point of getting into their technology is quite a bit higher than what we have. Now, our virtualization technology with Hyper-V is going to be built into the OS. It's a server role. So there's nothing that necessarily needs to be purchased other than your server license in order to use this.
Yeah, and as I understand it, you can get, you know, a version of it that doesn't, you know,
yes,
a version of the OS that doesn't include the virtualization if you want to, if you said that's just not my strategy or whatever.
Exactly.
And I think that's like 20 US dollars, and it depends on how you purchase it. It's like $26 or something like that.
Yeah,
right?
I can't confirm or deny what the pricing is on it. It's
going to
be dependent on your contracts.
Right.
Exactly. So, I mean, if you have any additional questions on what the licensing model looks like for it, we can go ahead and post it up onto your blog, Larry, and
okay,
give everybody the information they need as far as what it looks like from a production standpoint. But I would say that my initial comment about how the licensing works, if you want to look at it from a general standpoint, we'll put that up on your website. But if you have specific questions, definitely contact your account team.
Yeah, because every customer's got a little different arrangement.
Yeah,
you
never know what.
And I think that I heard that the list price was like, you know, if you get Windows Server 2008 without the Hyper-V, it's like $26.
Yeah.
And again, U.S.
Yeah, the price point is very attractive,
that's cheap,
I would say.
I mean,
for virtualization technology.
Yeah, I mean, I pay more for a baseball ticket, and I think I took my wife to a movie the other night, and we spent more than that on two tickets and some popcorn.
Well, it's the popcorn that costs you.
Yeah. Well, it costs you the next day.
In more
day
than
on,
one way.
Yeah, on the hips, right? Okay, so I've got, you know, so I went to MSDN, and I've downloaded it. You know, I've come to grips with the fact that I'm, you know, got a beta role on here, right? We must have a lot of confidence to bundle a beta role, you know, with the RTM bets.
We do. Yeah. So the thing that has struck me from the product team and all of our internal distribution list and all of the talk that comes across all of that is how stable even the beta bits are.
Right.
And even as we iterate forward on our versions of it internally, it just gets better and better and better. So we wanted to make sure that we were able to get our customers exposed to this technology now. And once we go to production with it, because it was going to be debatable whether or not you consider 180 days of rapid, but you know, having this technology in your hands, get used to it. Because we don't want just our developers to get used to this technology. We want our IT pros to get used to this technology.
Yeah, and that's
the longer, vastly different.
That's the longer ramp time, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's easy for me as an individual to install this on a machine. To roll it out to 5,000 existing servers is probably something you need to plan for, test for.
Absolutely.
And I think that, you know, your lab environment, you know, in your corporation is probably a great place to start playing around with Hyper-V right now.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So usually when you think of a dev and a test environment, you look at it from a development standpoint. I live in the IT pro world. So the way that I look at it for an IT pro to get their hands on this technology, think of it from a patching standpoint. I mean, imagine having a library of your production environment, you know, depending on what you need to patch. Okay, Patch Tuesday comes out. How easy is it going to be for you to replicate and get those patches tested? So the idea of having the beta bits in our release in your lab is the IT pros are now going to be able to get their hands on that technology, get used to that technology, understand it, so that when they actually start looking at it to roll out, then it's going to be an easy, I don't know what the word is. I'm losing my
word. It's an easy transition.
Thank you. Easy transition.
Okay.
Sorry, too much coffee.
So on my development machine here, and I think I've got a really tricked out machine for this. You know, we've talked about this. You know, I've got a Dell, you know, D820 and all. And
got the Mac Daddy.
Yeah, and manufacturer side and all that. What I think is so good about it is it's got 4 gig of RAM on it, and I've gotten through the whole, you know, gotten the latest firmware, all that kind of stuff. So if I install a 64-bit OS on here, my OS is seeing the full 4 gig.
That's
you
right.
Know, and RAM is kind of going to be your constraining thing, especially when you throw it on a laptop.
Right. So two huge requirements that there are to using Hyper-V. The first one is you can only run it on 64-bit. That's it.
Okay.
That's it. That is your entry point into Hyper-V.
And that's the first OS that gets installed. I don't want to call it the host OS like we used to talk about with, you know, virtual server.
Right.
The first OS has to be 64-bit. My additional OSs could be 32-bit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There's support for both 64-bit and 32-bit OSs on top of the hypervisor and the parent partition.
But my first one, so when I go out to MSDN to download it, I got to grab the Windows Server 2008 64-bit version.
That's right. That's right. So the other requirement that you need to have on your hardware, regardless of whether it's a laptop or a server, is you have to have that hardware-assisted virtualization technology on there. So that'd be the AMD VT or the Intel
version of it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. So I had a long drive to Madison today from Chicago. So those are the two big requirements.
And that's really easy to check,
sure.
You know, on, you know, either the AMD or the Intel website, whether your machine's
even,
got it.
Or even your machine's, you know, website, you know, the OEM website to find out whether or not they have that. So those are the things that you have to
get into
for the entry point.
Even if I have a hot server from a couple years ago, the chipset's probably not going to support the hardware-assisted virtualization.
Right. So our recommendation there would be, we know that there's going to be organizations that have maybe multiple servers that are still maybe perhaps not end of life, or they're just not on a cycle where they can be replaced quite yet. But what we have done is given support for running virtual server 2005 on server 2008 so that, you know, you could continue that legacy 32-bit support on your server OSs.
Cool. The other thing I like about this machine, you know, it's all about me today.
Because
Server Girl is helping me, you know, me put Hyper-V on my laptop.
You and a couple other people on our team.
Yeah. Is what I also like about this is I've actually got a second hard drive in here.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually rip out the optical drive.
Yep.
And I can actually put in a second hard drive, which, you know, if I look at the VHD in the physical location, I'm still going to get a boost out of having mm-hmm. two separate spindles.
It's all about I.O.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good thing.
So there was a lot of intention, you know, as to which machine I was going to put it
right.
on. Okay, so I put my optical drive back in. Mm-hmm. I grab my DVD that I burned off of MSDN. Mm-hmm. I install, you know, Server 2008. Mm-hmm. It's going to, you know, it's actually, I've done this already, mm-hmm. you know. I'll go ahead and tell everybody out there, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so we're acting like, you know, she's telling me this,
right,
but
exactly.
She's actually walked me through this already. You know, I can install it, and you're right, the experience is a lot different than installing Server 2003
right.
or even Vista. It's a very streamlined install. Mm-hmm. I went with Server Core, which I'll ask
Good
you about
job.
In a second.
Good
yeah.
job.
Literally, it was like, you know, 8-9 minutes, it seemed like.
Yeah.
And that was coming off of the DVD ROM.
Yeah.
So there was some, you know, some seek time, you know, in there. You know, so I got in and I faced Server Core for the first time. It said preparing your desktop, which I'm used to, and then I got a command prompt.
Yeah.
So tell us about Server Core.
Okay. All right. So well, let's just take one quick step backwards in the
okay.
installation, the way the installation experience is going to happen for you. So you're going to get faced with two choices when you first install Server 2008. The first one is going to be, do you want to run the full version of Server 2008 or do you want to run Server Core? Now, Server Core is that stripped down, real lightweight version of Server 2008. And when we are looking to the future as a best practice in terms of virtualization, our best practice is going to be load Server Core with Hyper-V sitting on top of that as a server role. So that's going to be our best practice. Now, Server Core being the stripped down version of the operating system means less things to patch. It definitely reduces your security threat surface area.
Yep.
So it's really, really lightweight. So, sorry, we're in a room full of people. We just had someone sneeze. God bless.
Bless you.
Bless you. So, Server Core is.
And also, it's gonna have less services started, so it's gonna use less of the resources.
It's not necessarily less services started. Think of it as less services. The bits just simply are not there.
Right.
So that was one of the biggest things in terms of feedback, and one of the reasons why we developed this version of Server 2008 was because, look, I've got all of these services that are loaded. They may not be started. However, when patching comes out or there's a vulnerability that comes out, I still have to patch for that because those bits are still there. And Server Core, the bits aren't there. So there's no patching for IE, say, for example.
Right.
There's going to be no patching for Windows Media. I mean, who loads that on their server anyway? I know that some people do. And yes, that's my phone that you just heard ding-a-ling, everybody. So the whole reason why we did Server Core was to remove those components and just give you what you need to run. So anyway, so that's what Server Core is. And so you've got two options to load when you're first installing Server 2008. You can either load Server Core or the full version.
And the recommendation kind of is if you really want to learn about virtualization and you don't want to do something with the, you know, the first operating system. Again, I want to say host operating system, but it's not the host.
It's not.
You know, is I want to go with, you know, the lightest weight one possible. And then,
you know, that really depends.
I guess it does depend,
it
right?
It really does depend.
In my case, I don't want to do anything with the
right.
first operating system. I'm just using this as my bootstrap mm-hmm. for Hyper-V.
Right. So one of the things that you have to understand with Server Core is there is no desktop. You have a command prompt.
Yeah, it did freak me out when it said preparing desktop.
Yeah. And there is no desktop.
I think I IM'd you when that happened. I said, whoa, it's saying preparing desktop. Am I going to get a desktop? And no, you
relax. Just deep breath, Larry.
Just a command
okay.
prompt, yeah.
So it's just a command prompt. So there's no UI at all necessarily with Server Core. You just get your command prompt. So everything is done via command line if you are sitting at the console.
Yep.
So you can still manage that server, however, remotely like most administrators do from your desktop using MMC. But you're never going to be able, if you are ever to try to do like an RDP connection to the terminal or RDP connection to the server, you're going to be presented with a command prompt.
Right.
There's going to be, you know, no...
And that's desktop. And that's an important thing, because that was one of the first things that I told you. I said, okay, wait, I've got this command prompt. And I grew up in DOS and Unix, you know, so pre-Windows 3.1. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, I'm showing my age here. But, you know, so I'm very used to the command prompt. You're, you know, three switches away from doing anything in the OS, right? You know, you basically own it at the command prompt. You just got to remember what all the commands are.
Right.
I was like, okay, what do I do now? How do I enable Hyper-V? Because, you know, you said there's two options. You sent me the command line version, which I used. But I could also go to my Vista machine running on the same network and install some tools. Tell us about those tools.
So tools as far as administering your Hyper-V. Okay, so this is really cool. We just released a whole new MMC snap-in to manage your Hyper-Vs.
Right, and that's the on the first time I did this, I actually used the command prompt, and after that I said no, I've been spoiled in the last 15 years. I've got to go get the GUI.
Yeah.
And I installed it. I had a Vista machine running on the same network. I had to, you know, provide the right credentials for the administrator, you know, for the machine. But then I was administrating it like it was, you know, a GUI.
Yeah.
It's just I was on the laptop next to, you know, my 2B Hyper-V machine.
Yeah, that MMC actually was a really good release, and it's really, really handy. So instead of going and managing a computer, you know, and say, okay, well, here I see all my services. Now I have an MMC snap-in that'll actually help me manage all of my different Hyper-Vs that I may have out there. So
that's the Hyper-V manager for Windows Vista. It's probably a search term that'll get you landed on it.
Yeah.
And we actually released something else to the web recently, and that is the RC1 version. We're talking about beta 3 of the Hyper-V manager, which actually is on the disk. But there's actually a separate download now that we can install.
RC0.
Yeah, RC0, that's right.
You want it bad.
This is a development show. We have to start counting at zero, right?
Right. So RC0 is right now, we are looking at that internally.
No, it's released.
Has it been released out onto the public?
Server girl, I've taught you something. Yes. And I think if you're listening to the show, you know, go check to see what the most recent one is, right?
Right.
You know, because if you're listening to the show and, you know, in 2 months from now, you know,
you're going
to
start seeing the iterations
come
a lot quicker
be,
now.
It may be RC2 or maybe, you know, eventually this will be a released product.
Yeah. As of this recording, it is RC0.
Yep.
We just got done with our internal testing of that and internal feedback. So if you do grab the RC1 bits, and you have been working with the beta 3 bits, please pay particular attention to the upgrade path between beta 3 and RC0, because there are some steps that you have to take in order to convert your existing VMs and your parent partition, especially with our ICs for that, which are our integration components. There's an upgrade path that you have to follow with those. But after RC0, any iterations that happen after that, you won't have to jump through as many hoops in order to get it to work, because this was such a big change.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the people, you know, listening who've worked with our betas and our RCs before, they're used to that. The beta is going to have some breaking changes, but the RC is just kind of fit and finish for the most part. Mm-hmm. It's very rare that you'd see a breaking change, and if you do, you know, we're going to scream loud and proud about it.
Right.
You know, one of the things that I noticed is when I downloaded the RC0. I didn't have any VMs created, so I didn't have to go down that upgrade path. So that's specifically if you've been working with, you know, the beta 3 version and you need to upgrade the existing VMs. If you're just creating new VMs, you can just install the RC and go on.
Yes. Well, and there's some additional instructions that go along with that. So just pay attention to the instructions. They're really good.
Yep.
If I can understand them, you can. Let's just say that. It's important to follow those, and you know, RC0 is definitely better than beta 3.
Right.
So moving forward, I would, if you've already got it going, go grab the RC bits and get moving with the newer stuff, because we got some good improvements in there.
And this was the really neat part, you know. So now that I've gotten all the, you know, the baseline stuff done, is I actually went to go create my first, you know, virtual machine.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of used to how we did it in virtual PC that had just a ton of wizards, you know, click next, all right, just give me something, right? That's been really streamlined.
Yeah.
And what I really liked about it was I could say, give me a new virtual machine, you know, on Hyper-V. Mm-hmm. It actually said, like, where do you want to put it, you know. I could also say I want to install it from this location, and I could point to an ISO, or I could point to the actual optical drive on my machine. And I, at this point, I had Vista 32 just sitting in the optical drive, and I said, yeah, go do.
Yeah.
And I was amazed. The machine started up, you know, did its, you know, you know, kind of configuration build itself. And then it started installing Vista. Mm-hmm. And I went full screen on that, and the experience was just like I was installing Vista on the hardware.
So, okay, so I have a question for you, Mr. Thirsty Developer. So, what did you think of the UI experience in Server Manager for doing that?
I thought it was great because I think it was like three clicks. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't, you know, it didn't seem like a consumer application. It seemed like, you know, here's somebody who knows what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I think they gave you a pass to click on advanced things if you wanted to change stuff. But it asked me the pertinent stuff. Where do you want to put the VHD? You know, because I have two hard drives, so I could target it at two different locations. How much RAM do you want? And then how do you want to install this thing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I haven't done is grabbed, I've got existing VHDs sitting out there. You know, I've got one for SharePoint. Mm-hmm. I've got the Ubuntu one that I told you about earlier. Mm-hmm. I haven't grabbed an existing one and tried the upgrade path, but I know that that's well documented. I did look at the steps involved in that.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. I forwarded those off to my entire team. Yeah. So it's a really, really good installation experience from start to finish, I think. So if you want to get technical on what the installation looks like, Larry, if you will allow me. So when we install, when you first install, you get faced with the choice of server core or full install. Let's just say, for sake of argument, you choose full install. Keep in mind, Hyper-V virtualization is a server role. So we have several different server roles in Server 2008. You can do domain services, which would be your Active Directory stuff. It could be a DNS server. DNS is a server role. DHCP is a server role. File print, you know, file is a server role. Print is a server role. So once you get it installed, right now you have server that's sitting right on the hardware, sitting right on top of it.
Yep.
A standard traditional server operating system on a server or laptop, whatever. When you choose to do the Hyper-V role, what it's going to do is prepare your machine, and then on the next reboot, it's going to put our hypervisor between your OS and the hardware. So your OS essentially becomes the first virtual machine, and we call that the parent partition.
Yeah, and this I think is the big shift if you've worked with virtual PC or virtual server in the past.
Right.
And that's why I think I pointed out that I kept wanting to say host, and it's not host, it's first OS.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we changed the paradigm. Additional OSs beyond the first one don't install on top of that. They install next to it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Next to it.
And so what this really means is each one of those virtual machines gets direct access to the hardware itself.
That's not necessarily true.
Oh, via the hypervisor,
well,
right?
So what happens
Teach
is,
me, server girl.
Okay. So when you – what we've done is we've done, like, degrees of isolation up. So your parent partition contains things like the API for management. More importantly, what it does is we have this new architecture with Hyper-V. We have a microkernelized hypervisor, and then the parent partition contains things like virtual server services. So we've got your VM bus, which is what communicates between the child partitions and the parent partition to communicate back down to the hardware.
Okay.
And so it runs over the VM bus. So there is a degree of separation between your child partitions and the hardware, because you never want your child partitions to touch the hardware. And we know that our government employees, they get kind of freaky about this kind of thing. So they really, really want to have that degree of isolation. Plus, from an I/O standpoint, the VM bus between the child partition and the parent partition down to the hypervisor through the hardware is much, much more efficient than the way that we did it with virtual server.
So you're not hitting bare metal, mm-mm, but you're hitting a very lightweight, you know, the version. You're not actually going through the full OS.
Mm-mm.
You know, and most of the developers listening to the show, you know, have heard the term, like, each additional layer of abstraction is a mm-hmm good thing.
Right.
And that's what you've done here is,
yes,
you've abstracted the hardware. So there's still a lot of protection for the actual hardware, so two VMs can't, you know, go after the
right
same piece of memory.
Because if you think about it, when the hypervisor sitting on top of the hardware is very highly privileged space. So you don't want someone to attack one of your child partitions and then have them hijack memory and, you know, have that be a way of infiltrating your system. So each one of the child partitions has their own VM bus to the parent partition with their own virtual server client pieces that say, hey, you know, I need access to the network card. So it's a lot more efficient I/O in terms of accessing your hardware devices between your child partitions and the hardware.
So one last question,
mm-hmm,
and or at least one. And that is, you know, so my additional operating systems, I'm locked into Windows Server 2008, 64-bit on the first one. What are the limitations for the other operating systems? I mean, we've talked about how we can do Vista, we can do XP. Mm-hmm. There's some Linux support there and all. But is there anything I can't do in those other operating systems?
Well, we get a lot of questions about what VMware supports and what Microsoft supports. And say, oh, VMware has such much, much bigger support. So if you really want to look in terms of support, what does supported mean from a Microsoft standpoint and what maybe somebody else may consider it? When we say support, we say we still are doing, you know, continued engineering on it. We still provide patches for it and those kinds of things. So if you want to run NT in a child partition, you can, but you won't be supported.
Yeah, and my question is more about from a developer, something I can get up and start working with.
Oh.
And I've got, by the way, one of the things you can get on the MSDN subscription is the Windows 3.1.1 install. You know, and that's
if you choose to install it.
I know I can't call somebody and say, hey, my Windows 3.1.1's not working. Yeah, but no, I love the look of Windows 3.1.1. I've actually got, you know, an old laptop that I've got it installed on right now, and it's a good joke that you break it out, so, you know, show somebody that you're running
look,
it.
I can still code on this.
Yeah, you do need a floppy disk to get it really installed, you know, easily. So
oh my gosh, I don't think even
do you remember those?
I don't even have a floppy drive on my laptop.
So there's the difference between support and yes. You know, able to get it run, but most OSs, like you said, you can get NT working on there. But you know, again, it's, you know, if there's an issue, you know, you might
be
on your own.
Do not expect to call us and get support. NT is long, long out of support, and it's never going to be supported with Hyper-V. But in terms of what you can put on there now from a supported standpoint, obviously Server 2008, 32-bit, 64-bit doesn't matter. Server 2003, XP, Vista. I think we have a couple versions of Linux that you could put up on there. We have a partnership with Xen, which is owned by Citrix now.
Right.
So we have Linux support, and I'm sure there's a whole host of others, but at the top of my mind, I can't think of them.
Yeah, and again, there's a difference between what's, you know, officially supported, what you can find documentation on, and then what you could actually get to work.
Take a look really, really closely at VMware's statement on support. So, you know, it's like kind of one of those things where it's best effort. So just keep that in mind, you know. You know, let's clear the FUD out a little bit here.
Right.
So it's don't expect VMware to support an operating system that is no longer supported by the people who made it.
Right.
So
and I think
that's
and
really
again
the bottom line.
I think most of the people listening to this are more like, you know, what can I get to work to play with? Because I think it'd be, you know, really just cool.
If you want a sandbox, go for it.
And I think that's the perfect thing. I don't want to dedicate. I've been looking on eBay for an old copy of OS 2, like 2.1. I'm a history nut, so I want to recreate the.
I thought you meant you were only in history and like real history, not technology history.
No, I want to recreate the 90s. You know. And my goal is I want to find, you know, for like, you know, 2 months in the 90s, Next, which was Steve Jobs' company before he went back to Apple, created an Intel 386 version of the Next OS. And that's my current goal is to find that, because I'd love to have, you know, running on Hyper-V, I'd love to have all these old operating systems. And I'll let you know how you've unleashed a monster is what you've done.
It'll truly be that legacy box.
Yeah. Wow. So it looks like it's time to break for lunch here,
right.
But we'd like to have you back on the show in the future.
I would love to be.
Thanks
on
for
show,
getting
man.
Us started with Hyper-V for developers. Mm-hmm. And how can people reach you?
You can reach me at I haven't really put up a specific email address for Server Girl yet, but from a Microsoft standpoint, my email address is Beth Hum. So that's BethHum at Microsoft.com.
Great. Well, thanks for being on Thirsty Developer.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
So, Larry, you know, this Hyper-V, it's obviously it's very cool stuff, but, you know, I have to be honest with you. So me as a developer, I'm not quite sure, you know, where do I need to start? So I have a laptop. I have this old Toshiba Tekker M7 laptop that's just kind of, you know, sort of my demo machine at this point in time. So how can I find out if I can even get Hyper-V on this particular machine? I mean, obviously Hyper-V runs on certain can only run on certain machines. How do you find out if your machine can support Hyper-V?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing is to start looking at the hardware specs, because first of all, you want a machine that's going to be able to run Windows, you know, effectively. So if it's an old machine from 3-4 years ago, and by Windows I mean Windows Server 2008, you know, you know, and then you also want to check to make sure that the 64-bit virtual extensions are available via the BIOS. And you probably have to go to a combination of the Microsoft website and then your hardware manufacturer's website to make sure you've kind of got those pieces in place. But, you know, once you've kind of got the hardware squared away, you say, yeah, I think this is a good machine. And I think I explained that, you know, I've got a really good laptop because it's got two different spindles, two different hard drives.
Yeah, your Dell.
4 gig of RAM.
Was it Dell 830?
820. It's last year's model.
Okay.
But, you know, but then you start off by installing as your operating system, Windows Server 2008, 64-bit. And that's the only one that's available on currently. And because of the whole, you know, it's still in the preview beta RC, you know, type phase. And that'll change as time goes on. But you install Windows Server 2008, and I installed the server core. So just the command line version of it. And
so essentially just the bare bones, you know, give me an operating system and just a command line, that's it.
And because the only thing I want to use that is to kind of boot the machine and get, you know, the Hyper-V manager going. So then on another machine on my network, I installed just a Vista machine. There's the Hyper-V tools for Windows Vista. And that allowed me to reach out to the other machine on the network, the Windows Server core machine, and to do all the work. Because I need a GUI. The command line, I used to be the command line king, but I'm not anymore. And then it's simple as, you know, it's almost, I hate to call it a wizard because I think it's only like two or three steps for each one. It's not like you got to go through and, you know, make multiple selections. They've really streamlined the process of setting up a new virtual machine. And what I did was I did most of mine from scratch. You know, so I would say, give me a new virtual machine, put the hard drive, put the VHD file here and, you know, boot it from the optical drive on the machine. And I set up a Windows Vista machine. I set up a XP machine, and I've even got you know, a version of Linux with Ubuntu. I always mispronounce it, but I've got those three running, you know, up now. The only problem that I had, and this kind of takes some forethought, is I needed the optical drive to install those operating systems, but then that's the same bay of my second hard drive. So what I had to do was set the drives up on the first spindle and then move them over later to the second spindle.
Interesting. Okay. That might require a blog post to get the details.
I just like kind of walk through the step by steps. It's very easy. You do need to, you know, the thought ahead of time is it's unlike virtual PC or virtual server. You can't just say, I've got my existing machine, I'm going to install it on here.
Right.
Because you have to kind of reinstall the primary or the first OS.
Right. So here's the confusion that I have is, isn't Hyper-V, isn't that kind of coming down to the hardware level where they're going to be having sort of processors or even buses that support Hyper-V? What do you know anything about that?
It's a lot closer to the hardware than, but before every call used to have to go through, you know, the from the guest OS, used to have to go through the host OS, you know, kind of up and down the whole stack.
Right.
It's really streamlined now, and that's because the actual, you know, BIOS on the machine has got these, you know, these virtualization extensions on it.
Right.
You know, to allow that kind of interoperability.
Right.
So it's a combination of the host OS, you know, being Hyper-V aware, and I keep saying host, you know, the first OS on the machine, the Windows Server 2008, and the actual hardware extensions to make those things capable. It's not true hardware, so the guest operating system is not, you know, dealing directly with the hardware.
But it's closer than it's ever been.
Yeah, it's you know, really close to the bare metal.
Right. So you know, you had a second machine available to you to kind of, you know, install this wizard to communicate over to the machine where the Hyper-V was installed. So if you just installed Windows Server Core, obviously you can just use the command line from there to kind of create. Like, how does that work? I mean, you're right. We've been in sort of this Windows world for so long. You know, I came from a Unix background, you know, way back in the day, and what I was all about command line. And I haven't touched the command line I don't know how long, you know, on a regular basis, that you kind of forget, you know, how you went about doing things. So in the Windows Server Core environment where you just have the command line, like, how would you go about setting up a virtualized environment? Is it just all command line instructions at that point? Just step one, step two, step three, or?
Yeah, so each of the steps that I went through, the first thing you need to do on Windows Server 2008 is enable Hyper-V, enable that role. And it, you know, if you do a search for it, maybe we'll put the a link to a good blog post, you know, in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a well published command line for here's how you enable Hyper-V. At that point, once Hyper-V is on that machine, then you can manage it from the GUI or the command line equivalents for creating a new virtual machine and setting the startup location. You know, in my case, it was grab the DVD drive. It could also be an ISO sitting on the machine too as your startup.
Right. Actually, this would be a good candidate for like a screencast or something. So there might be one up on TechNet. We might be able to find out or point people to. But it definitely sounds very interesting because I know, I'm always when I'm using like virtual PC or virtual server and just trying to, which one is better, right? Do you use virtual PC? Do you use virtual server? Virtual server is, supposedly runs better in virtual PC, but it's a little bit more difficult to set up. And, virtual PC is more kind of client-based, but it's not as performant. So, but now it's kind of like, let's throw those out. And now we have, Windows Server 2008 with Hyper-V, and that's the way to go.
Yeah, I think the answer is that if you've got a machine capable of Hyper-V, that's probably your best solution. Given the fact that you may not have control over the machine, to be able to reinstall the operating system, things like that, virtual PC 2007 and virtual server 2005 R2, I think, is the latest version. Both those are still good platforms, and they're going to be supported for a while because of the older hardware that may not support the virtualization right. extensions and the fact that you don't have control over it. Virtual PC is great because it's just an application that you install.
Yeah, there's a little bit more of a requirement than just having the right software. You have to have the right machine as well.
So I know you've got a blog you should know pick for this week that's kind of on topic.
It is on topic, actually. He might have to rename his blog, but I don't know if he can do that now because of his link. But it's actually the Virtual PC Guy. And so it's at blogs.msdn.com/virtual_PC_guy. And we'll have a link to that as well. But essentially, it's the blog of Ben Armstrong. He's the program manager of the virtualization team at Microsoft. And he has an outstanding blog. I mean, anytime I run into any issues with virtualization, around virtual PC, virtual server, and even now with Hyper-V, I mean, his blog is the one that comes up in most search engines on the hits, and it's one that I, have bookmarked and read frequently. But actually, what's great about his blog is not only does he kind of walk you through the different nuances of virtualization, how to get things set up, but he kind of has this little series of where he takes old computer games and shows how they can run in a virtualized environment. So as an example, just recently he posted about how he created a virtualized environment to run the old Risk game from 1989. One of my personal favorites, things like Command and Conquer, it's running in a virtualized environment, and also X-Wing, which was actually a DOS game running inside a virtualization environment. So it's actually kind of cool how he kind of showcases off the virtualized environment and how these old you could take those old computer games that you got stashed away in in your attic somewhere and go back and install them and live out your glory days once again. But so that's the Virtual PC Guy, and he's got a lot of great information. And like I said, we'll put the link up there on the show notes.
Yeah, it's a great technology. The only thing I keep running into is that most of those games that I have from the old school days are 5 1/4. And I have enough trouble finding a 3.5-inch drive these days. What I need to do is find if somebody's got like a 5 1/4 USB drive and just buy one and just kind of keep it around just for situations like that.
That's right. So what's your blog?
My blog, you should know, is the Win Super Site. And
yes, Paul Thurrott.
Paul Thurrott.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it's winsupersite.com. And of course, we'll put a link up there. When Microsoft makes an announcement, I have to admit, I go to the Microsoft press page, kind of read about it a little bit, and then in a day or so, when he's had a chance to digest it and to publish his thoughts on it, I always run over and say, well, what does Paul Thurrott think of this? He doesn't work for Microsoft. I think that we've got a fairly good mix. About half our blogs, you should know, are Microsoft, and about half of them aren't. He's definitely one of these, Windows experts that everybody looks to, for the latest information and a lot of insight on how you can use the technology. And just like the Virtual PC Guys, if you do a search on a Windows topic, Paul Thurrott's going to be one of the top hits, kind of 9 times out of 10.
Right. It's Paul is actually he also has a podcast with Leo Laporte. It's called Windows Weekly, and it's one that's on my list of podcasts I listen to every week. Or you know, they call it Windows Weekly, and sometimes they don't get a chance to post weekly just because they're busy doing other things. But it's a great podcast. You know, Leo Laporte's kind of known as one of these guys who's a little bit. He tries to say that he's neutral, but you know he's really not. You know he's really a Mac head, and of course everything that Apple does is great, and everything that you know Microsoft does, you know he's always got to criticize. And even though Paul has his criticisms, he also supports them when they do the things right as well. And what's great about Paul is he's actually a huge Xbox 360 fan as well, and I think he has his gamer tag posted up on his blog as well, so you can send out a friend request to Paul Thurrott and maybe get him on the Xbox 360 and ask him about Windows questions. But he's not just a Windows expert, but he's kind of a Microsoft expert. I mean, he goes into every little detail about everything that Microsoft is doing. And I know some of the stuff he's looking into recently is our recent announcements around the mesh, you know, announcements that we've had, which should be like another interview that we should look to have in a future podcast of ourselves to kind of explain what this whole mesh thing's about. But but he kind of looks at everything that Microsoft does and provides kind of an outside view on it. And it's not your typical Mary Jo view, but it's, you know, Paul Thurrott's, you know, unbiased view.
So, Dave, should we wrap it up?
Yeah, absolutely. So with our sort of beginning conversations around virtual worlds, and now we're talking about virtualization, and it's all, you know, come together as a great show, I think. And so what I would like to ask the audience, the listeners out there, is what kind of topics would you guys like us to discuss? You know, is there some other things that you'd like to know more about? You know, we can track down the appropriate resources, the subject matter experts, and try to get them, you know, on the Thirsty Developer to discuss it further. So if you have any suggestions or comments for the show, certainly send us an email. You can send that to thirstydeveloper@live.com. And then, of course, as always, you can comment on each and every show at thirstydeveloper.com.